If you do anal a lot, will your butthole stretch like to the point where like it can't close up anymore?
Is there a reality where erotic material isn't harmful?
Why, for women, is lesbian porn like the choice?
Does that make them lesbian?
Did you just say meat?
What do you do when you queef?
I love driving around up here with being in the mountains.
It kind of feels like a little bit away.
It totally does.
I used to live in Santa Monica.
Okay.
And it was crazy.
A mission to get here.
How would you even get here? You have to get on the 405 and come all the way north?
I'm from Texas. I was born and raised in El Paso, Texas. When I first moved here, I was kind of culture shock. I was like, what's going on?
I mean, listen, I would never leave if I had a treehouse, honestly. I would take my sessions up there. It's awesome.
So calming.
Okay. Shall we start?
Let's do it.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Ease. We are so excited today because we are going to have a really fun conversation with the one and only Dr. Kate.
Woo!
Can we get a round of applause? Dr. Kate. Dr. Kate is a top-rated sex-positive therapist. She is a licensed clinical psychologist and forensic psychologist, which is amazing, and also the founder of Modern Intimacy, the host of the podcast Get Naked with Dr. Kate. She's also an author. She wrote the book What Happened to My Sex Life. And we are just so excited to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Kate.
Thank you. Thank you. First of all, can you just be my hype human? That was an awesome intro.
This was my first intro. I might have to re-record it, but you know what?
We are so happy to have you, and we're so thrilled that you came all the way over here for us. We just want to address to our audience that we're not here to talk about sex positions. We're not here to talk about how to give your boyfriend the gluck, gluck, gluck. We're literally here just to probably discover more about ourselves, more about the stigmas and stereotypes that come with the topic. If you could tell us more about yourself, Dr. Kate, that would be amazing. We'd love to hear more.
Yeah, of course. Well, again, thank you for inviting me on your show. As you mentioned, I'm a licensed psychologist, clinical and forensic, a certified sex therapist, and I own a therapy practice that has providers across the country. And we really focus on helping people with whatever they're working on at that intersection of mental health, relationships, and sexuality. So
that's amazing.
It's really, I feel so lucky to do the work, honestly. It's great.
Yeah. What first called you and interested you in being a sex therapist?
Yeah, I kind of got into this work in a really indirect way. I used to work in prisons with committed sex offenders. And when I was working with them, I realized that they had just really poor relational skills, not surprising. But also they really didn't know a lot about sex. That, for some of them, was part of how they went down the rabbit hole of making the decisions they made to engage in offending behavior. So the more we talked about things like consent and pleasure and anatomy and the realities of sex, the more it made sense to them, and that could be a path into a rehabilitated state for them. So I started really clocking, wow, these folks don't know a lot about sex. I'm curious what non-sex offender folks in the world think about sex. And I realized there was a lot I didn't know. So as I started learning more and more, I thought, well, everyone else needs to know this stuff too, right? This is really important. And I came down this path, and now sex therapy is really... sex therapy and couples therapy is pretty much all I do.
Whoa. So when you were working at in prisons, you were actually in facilities?
Yeah.
Whoa.
I've worked in 5.
Wow. So you were talking to convicted sex offenders and kind of just picking their brains, seeing how they worked. Were you doing some sort of study?
No, I was doing evaluations and treatment. So I worked with sexually violent persons. I worked with non-sexually violent persons. So I would try to understand what was happening for them, what made them do the things they did. And then if they were someone who was up for parole, I would help them achieve the goals they needed to really become eligible and to reduce their risk of harm in society. So we did a lot of treatment. I did some expert witness testimony in the courts. So yeah, lots of stuff like that.
Wow, that's so fascinating.
Mm-hmm. It was incredible work. I learned a lot.
Did you learn like more about yourself rather than like obviously the experiences that you did have, but like what's something that you did learn about yourself throughout the process?
I learned that I had a lot of biases that I wasn't aware of, and working in that setting helped me have a better understanding of systems and the systems of our society that create the landscape for a lot of the criminal behavior that we see for people who are incarcerated. Yeah. So honestly, I got to see the best of human behavior and the worst of human behavior in the prisons, and it's an experience that I'm really grateful for.
What do you mean by biases that you like previous, like that you already kind of came in to these meetings with, or like, you know?
Yeah, well, we all have tons of implicit biases, right? Biases we don't even know we have because we've just kind of grown up in our culture and with our families, with our religious backgrounds, whatever they might be. Everything about our lives informs how we see the world.
That's very true,
right? And we all think we have the corner on the truth.
Yeah.
Right. Those are our biases. And when you start to break those down and create more awareness around them, you can understand how you've been conditioned to think a certain way and feel certain ways and behave certain ways. And that's really powerful to deconstruct that. It gives us a lot more agency in how we show up for ourselves and with the people we care about and the rest of society.
Wow. That's fascinating. I feel like, I mean, this was a question we kind of had down the line, but now that you're like mentioning this, would you say that maybe, because I know with just sexuality and sensuality and like the topic of sex, I feel like it kind of can go hand in hand a little bit with misogyny?
For sure. So sex is one of the places where we probably have the most biases as humans. Whoa. Because there's so much sex negativity in our world. Misogyny is a huge perpetrator of sex negativity and double standards. Mm-hmm. And that creates all kinds of projections onto other people based on the kind of sex that we think people should or should not be having.
Whoa. Well, now I'm thinking of all the biases that I have.
Like, yeah.
Just growing up, like, and you don't mean to like adapt these opinions and like this like way of being. I speak like personally, I think growing up, the subject of sex was not really talked about a lot within like my family. I come from a really small family. Like I'm an only child, and I grew up with my mom, who's a single mother. So it was really just me and my mom. And we never talked about sex. It was just kind of like this, like, like, you know, you're too young. Like, you don't need to know about this. Like, if there was like sex on TV, like cover your eyes sort of thing. So I think I like naturally kind of adopted just like my mom's way of perceiving it, and I'm sure that she adopted that from her mom, and like it's kind of like this generational thing. What would you say is a healthy way of viewing sex?
What a great question. I think a good place to start is to eradicate shame from how you experience your own sexuality, whatever it may consist of. To keep it really simple, to not yuck other people's yum or your own, right?
Good so, advice.
Yeah, I think we live in a world that's really sex negative, and there's a lot of judgment that people put on themselves and on other people about their fantasies or their experiences sexually. So when we can just sort of step back and say, there's really no place for shame.
Yeah.
You can like what you like, right? As long as it's consensual, it's okay. Mm-hmm. And there's someone else who likes it too. You're not alone. But we really have to work hard sometimes to give ourselves permission to be sexual in the ways that we want to be.
Literally, we listen and we don't judge.
We listen and we don't judge. We let it happen.
Let it happen.
But you did mention fantasies, and I'm interested in, you had some content that went deep into that. Can you further explain how our fantasies aren't our real thoughts, and like, how does that work?
Ooh. Really good question. Okay, so absolutely, fantasies are something that you don't have to act on. For a lot of people, in fact, they don't want to act on them. That takes away the fun of it because it brings the fantasy into reality. And with reality,
yeah,
can sometimes take away some of the sparkle of the fantasy. But let's just take a pause for a second. Do you remember being kids and like playing silly games, make-believe games?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Little House on the Prairie.
Exactly. Wait, what? What do you mean?
I was pretending to be Laura Ingalls Wilder. But yeah, I remember.
I love that.
You play house, you play school, you play all these kinds of. What are you doing when you're kids playing games? Yeah. You're pretending. But what's the function of that?
It's fake.
Using your imagination. Yeah, and using your imagination. Yeah, it's pretend. Mm-hmm. It's fake.
You're learning.
Oh.
Right? Yeah. You're exploring. You're playing around in an imaginary space, and it lets you learn things about yourself, about how you feel, playing different characters or different roles. It lets you explore the world.
Yeah.
And as adults, our sexual fantasies are the same way, mm-hmm. right? That's they allow true. Us to feel an emotion or a physical sensation or to embody a character or a role or a set of personality traits that maybe we don't have access to in our everyday lives. So it's like a really cool way to learn about yourself and to play. It's all about play.
Yeah.
It is wow. your imagination, but like you don't have to do anything with it. It's like you are just playing a game.
Yeah, I kind of feel like sometimes, I don't know, maybe this might just be my opinion, but maybe sex can feel kind of like this like intense thing. And it can be light and it can be playful.
Yeah, it can be all the things.
It can be all the things.
In one sexual experience, it can be intense and playful and yeah. silly and more intense again. It yeah. can be all the things.
Yeah, you're right.
Hey.
Wow.
Get freaky. I'm just kidding. I'm just yes. kidding.
Speaking of freaky.
Speaking of freaky.
How much sex is too much sex?
Oh, that's for each person to decide for themselves.
Okay.
Right? Because one person's too much is another person's not enough. So here's yeah. where not yucking someone else's yum comes in handy.
Yeah.
So the thing that I would maybe think about is if you're having so much sex, either by yourself or with another person or people, that you're having a hard time functioning in life, mm-hmm. it might be time to rethink what you're doing and to rethink your relationship. So if you're having a hard time going to work, mm-hmm. getting your stuff done throughout the day, mm-hmm. taking care of yourself, addressing other responsibilities, then maybe it's time to go, okay, I can rethink my relationship with sex a little bit here. But otherwise, if you're functioning in all the ways that are important to you,
keep doing it.
Do
keep
you.
Doing you.
Do you.
As yeah. long as you're like getting your work done.
Well, yeah, and showing up like the way you want to show up. You're being the friend that you want to be. You're the partner that you want to be. You're showing up at work, or if you have kids, the parent you want to be. Yeah. Like, you're in your integrity. And if you're doing that, then yeah, I would say have at it.
Yeah, in your integrity. I like that quote.
Do you think it could go hand in hand with like addiction almost? Like in the way that when someone casually drinks, for example, it's like, okay, if you're just doing it once in a while, it's not getting in the way of your like life
little
becoming
sip.
This like big distraction. Is that kind of, can sex kind of become an addiction?
It's such a good question. I will say there's no clear consensus among mental health practitioners about whether or not sex and porn addiction are a thing. But what I will say is that some folks really can feel like sex is becoming out of control for them, or their porn use is becoming out of control. So I think it's important to honor that if someone's feeling really spun out and they're feeling like it's taking over their life in a way that doesn't work, then whatever we decide to call it or name it, it's a problem that they might want to address. Mm. And we can use the alcohol analogy, mm. but the reality is we don't need alcohol to survive as humans. Mm. We don't technically need sex with another person either, but we do need connection and we do need touch and we do need pleasure. Yes. So an abstinence model doesn't always work when we're talking about compulsive or problematic sexual behavior. So it's more about helping people renegotiate their relationship with sex so that they can have a happy, thriving, pleasurable sex life in a way that feels fulfilling and not in a way that sends them down this rabbit hole of consequences that they don't want in their life.
I see. Yeah. Can you go further and talk about the abstinence model? Is that, does that mean like someone being abstinent themselves or like just not having the type of what's called sex drive?
Yeah, so abstinence in this context means refraining from the behavior.
I see.
Right? So mm-hmm. not engaging in any sexual behavior. And there's some people who do that, and for them, they that works for them. So yeah. Again, I'm not here to yuck anyone's yum,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But for a lot of folks, it just isn't the relationship they want with sex for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to the abstinence moral, at least right now, because I am not seeing anyone right now. And maybe it's because the past couple of years, like, I have been in relationships, mm-hmm. but now I'm at a point where I just want to focus on my career, want to focus on other things. But does that ever negatively impact like the way I act? Because I mean, don't you get hormones from like
yeah.
sex and like...
Well, sure. There are lots of really good benefits that come yeah. from sex. We get a whole flood of neurochemical reactions in the body with pleasure. But you can have that with solo sex. You don't have to be partnered to experience that.
Yeah.
I think what I hear you talking about is celibacy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
So what is the difference between celibacy and being abstinent?
Yeah, they're really, really close cousins, I think.
Okay. I thought they were the same.
And for some people, they might be, right? But celibacy is often a choice to like not be in relationship and also not to be sexual. It's a choice. It's a, this isn't really what I'm interested in right now, or I'm going to take a break because maybe I've had some doozy relationships that I want to just get my
heal from.
Traction from after. Yeah. So abstinence is more like sobriety. I would say with abstinence, the way that I conceptualize the difference between abstinence and celibacy is that abstinence is a practice of refraining and containing because you really want to be engaging in that behavior or using that substance. Mm. Celibacy is a little different. You're like, not for me right now. It's actually not a huge priority. And so you're not necessarily struggling to maintain that celibacy.
Well, I grew up Seventh-day Adventist, so that's like a type of Christianity that I couldn't even go outside from like sunset on Fridays to like sunset Saturday. And my parents, you can already imagine like how strict they were with being Christian like that. And that kind of altered the way I do think of sex because I felt like my whole life, oh, you can only have sex until you're married. Like, that's what I was told.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm like, I built a similar relationship to it, like how my mom and dad have told me. But it's definitely changed. Like, I feel like with our generation, especially with hookup culture, yeah. too, there's a mix of everything, you know?
Totally. Yeah. And for some people, that path is really meaningful. It gives them purpose. It gives them a strong sense of connection with the partner they do eventually become sexual with. So that is a very valid, wonderful path. And for other folks, they can have different experiences and feel just as fulfilled and just as whole.
I feel like what you're kind of explaining and talking about is something that is kind of common with a lot of young people. I feel like there's either like no exposure to sex. It's almost like their parents are like, like don't do that. And so you kind of like go into it blind, figuring it out as you go, like what you hear from friends and stuff. I feel like if there was a more inviting way of approaching the conversation, I just think like taking care of one's body and like going into it kind of feeling more comfortable and knowing, because it's also like with sex, you start going into your like anatomy and figuring out
yeah.
how your body works and like what works for your body. If you like this, if you don't like this, if this hurts, if this doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like Would you say if you start learning about sex younger, is that harmful? Is that what's a good age to start like talking about?
Yeah, what a good question. So it depends on how you're talking about sex, right? When kids are around a lot of sex shaming or sex negative language, that can actually have really adverse effects on them growing up. Mm-hmm. But if kids are talked to in developmentally appropriate ways about their bodies, let's just start there.
Yeah.
You know, younger kids can learn all about their bodies and boundaries without there even being a conversation about sex. But it's like a prerequisite. Right? Mm-hmm. You want to learn about when it's okay to say yes and when it's okay to say no. Like when adults say, can I get a hug? Right? Mm-hmm. Do their parents encourage them to say yes, even when they're uncomfortable? Or do they give them the permission to say no if they're uncomfortable? This is a really subtle way that we start to teach young kids about who gets rights to their body mm-hmm. and who has permissions. Right?
Oh, yeah.
So this kind of conversation is really important for young kids so that they can start to understand that they have sovereignty in their body and they're the person who gets to say yay or nay.
Yeah.
Right. And then as they get older, you can start introducing more conversations about anatomy and using the real words, penis, vulva,
yeah.
vagina, testicles. These words are really important to teach kids because when we make them silly,
yeah.
I know a lot of parents are like, oh, but we just want to keep it light. And I yeah. so get that.
Yeah.
But when we make the words silly, then what we're teaching kids implicitly is that there's something to be ashamed of and that they can't take this seriously.
Or it's something that like make fun of because they are, yeah.
No, that's true. I think like it took, like, I think even now I've felt, well, maybe not so much now because I know this is a safe space with you, Dr. King.
Yeah.
But like when I'm like penis, space. I'm like, oh.
I know. I wonder how many listeners giggled when I said those words too. I mean, that's the thing. Like most of us grew up hearing code language for sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
So then we do giggle and yeah. feel silly or shy around it. So it's little things like this that early in kids' lives make a big difference later mm-hmm. for how comfortable they feel talking about these things, about their bodies, about boundaries, about pleasure. That's the stuff that helps prevent sexual violence.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of stuff that promotes healthy sex choices, like being comfortable having a conversation about STIs and protections and barriers and all of the things that help us have healthy, thriving sex lives. So,
wow.
Lean in.
Yeah, lean in. How would you advise a mom, I guess, to like address the subject to their kid if they are, say, they're going to high school, some girl gets a boyfriend, new boyfriend, and she feels like this topic has to be talked about?
Or even like with younger children too, like not in high school.
Yeah, I would say the tone that parents set about sex with their kids is really important. And if I had a dollar for every time somebody said, my parents never talked to me about sex, we would be having this conversation on my private island somewhere, honestly. But it's so important. Like, parents got to talk to their kids about sex in a way that isn't shamey, blamey. Like, parents, if you're listening, I get
Please.
It. Most of us grew up with super sex negative messages. So it's really important to think about how are you coming across? Do your kids feel a sense of anxiety when you're talking about sex from you? Do they feel judgment coming from you? So it's really important that parents get support if they don't know what to say. There's lots of really great resources out there. You can talk to sex therapists to kind of figure out where should I start?
Yeah.
Right. And then really being the person that your kids feel they can go to is a make or break for a lot of kids, especially if they get in over their head. Mm-hmm. If they feel scared to talk to their parents, that's when they are likely to make other decisions that compound the messiness.
That's true.
You know, but if they're like, hey, mom, this thing happened and I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And you're like, yeah, okay, let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a really powerful experience.
You were saying along the lines of having conversations about sex is important because it could stop or prevent sexual abuse when you know that you have control over your body and you have the right to say yes or no.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Again, so much of the conversations that we have with kids about lots of stuff,
yeah,
but especially uncomfortable stuff, sex, is a really implicit conversation. What does that mean? It means that we're not being very direct with kids. And when we are using like silly language or not talking with them about it, they don't know what to do if somebody approaches them and starts gradually grooming them to tolerate more touch, right? If kids don't know that they can say,
I was like, wait.
Yeah.
Okay, we're talking about that.
Yeah. It's real.
It's uncomfortable, but talking about, like, you get to say yes or no, and modeling that for your kids gives them permission to say no when someone does something that makes them uncomfortable, and they come talk to their parents about it sooner, or a trusted adult sooner, right? Because they'll say, I don't like when so-and-so does such and such to me, mm-hmm. right? And now they've been given permission to have that voice. So mm-hmm. it really empowers them to, you know, say the things, right? Yeah. And not sit in secrecy around it.
I think that's so powerful that you say that, because I do think that as people, we kind of shy away from the subject because it's like, oh, it's something you talk about in private. It's such a private, you know, intimate thing. Like, we don't talk about this, and especially not in front of like children, your family, your parents. But I think in ignoring that or kind of having this shame around it, I think it opens up for secrets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And almost like speaking about it, you're protecting your child. I think maybe parents feel this, like, maybe I'm not going to talk about it because I'm trying to protect my child.
Totally. Yeah.
When in reality, if you were to talk about it, that would actually be more beneficial.
Yeah. I mean, I trust that the majority of parents are really well-intentioned when they don't talk about this to their kids. Yeah. They don't have the language. They don't know when it's the right time. Mm-hmm. They really want to protect their kids from being exposed to things that could hurt them. And so I get it. But it definitely is an opportunity, right, for parents to kind of, you know, sit in something that might be a little uncomfortable in the moment, but could be a really important scaffolding for their kids to have.
So now that we're kind of on the subject of porn,
hey,
what are your feelings towards porn?
Oh, well, that's a big question. Here's what I'll say. Erotic material has existed since humans have existed, because humans are erotic beings.
Yeah.
So we've had statues of breasts and statues of phalluses and all kinds of erotic symbolism in art from early on in human culture. Some of our earliest human cultures.
Greek statues,
So porn is not new.
Yeah.
But what is newer is internet porn. Yeah. And the rate and the saturation with which we can experience it because of the internet. And so there's a lot of question about what is actually problematic. Is it the internet or is it the pornographic material and how it shapes our brains? Mm-hmm. But erotic material is not going away, right? Like I don't know that it needs to, but what I would love to see is a lot more sensitivity to how porn is made. I would love to see changing attitudes about sexuality so that we are having real conversations about the erotic material that exists online or in audio porn, or even if you want to go old school in print media.
Yeah. Playboy.
The thing that we have to remember about humans is that porn is created to represent the human experience. And so if we really want to change the porn industry, which can be very exploitative and, you know, can have all kinds of stuff that we could talk about, but erotic material itself is not a problem. I don't think it's how we use it and how it reflects what's going on in humans. So when you look at porn and you see a ton of misogyny, porn's not to blame for that. Humans are to blame for that. The person who created it, the person who's consuming it, it becomes a feedback loop, right? Mm-hmm. So if we think in misogynistic terms, we're going to make misogynistic material, and then we're going to consume misogynistic material. So instead of eradicating porn, let's eradicate misogyny.
Yeah.
And then what would porn look like?
You mentioned having conversations about porn that are intelligent and open. How do we begin to have those conversations?
To your question, can we have different conversations about it? If we really had a comprehensive sex education program that was nationwide and involved things like porn literacy, we could teach young folks how to critique what they're seeing so that they can separate fantasy from reality. Because a lot of people right now aren't getting good sex education in school. So they're watching porn and they're thinking that's real life. And it's not.
Yeah.
Right. So then they are with a partner and that experience is really different than what they're seeing. And they're like, why? It needs to look like that, right?
That's true.
And why aren't you having an orgasm 2 seconds after I stimulate you? Right? That's not realistic.
You ate.
You're right, Dr. Cape.
Yeah.
It's not realistic.
It's not realistic.
And that is why some boyfriends like compare porn in their relationship, because that they think sex should be this way. I was wondering, still going off of all of that and with the topic of porn, some, especially for women, this kind of, for me, I feel like, not me, but like, I don't know why it's so hard. It's
asking for a friend.
No.
Asking for a friend.
Okay, but we feel like.
Oh, I think I know what you're going to ask.
We feel like, why for women is lesbian porn like the choice?
The go-to.
Yeah, the go-to.
It's more enjoyable than normal porn.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of my female friends are like, if I'm watching porn, which like porn's all right.
Yeah.
I feel like I have a lot of friends who are kind of like, porn's all right. If I need it, if I'm going to watch it, it's usually lesbian.
Yeah.
What, even if they're like not necessarily.
Yeah. Does that make them lesbian
gay?
Or
it does not? No. Remember, porn is a fantasy, right?
Yeah.
And so when we're watching porn, we can relate to any of the characters that we're witnessing on porn, and often we do relate to more than one at the same time. So a lot of straight women watch lesbian porn because it centers female pleasure. There's no penis in there getting centered.
Oh,
right?
My God.
It's not a distraction.
Yeah. That makes so much sense.
That's almost like an easy answer. You're right.
Like, you get to really focus on sort of feeling like you could be that woman who's being pleasured. And for a lot of women, they're socialized to prioritize the pleasure of their male partner if they are in heterosexual dynamics. So that's a lot of how we socialize men too, right? To kind of bring the focus of whose sexual pleasure matters the most.
Yeah.
The person who has the penis. And this is why the orgasm gap is so big. Straight women have a hard time even seeing a man in porn because in their mind, they then sort of go into this experience of what is he experiencing. And so it takes them out of their own bodies. It takes them out of the ability to just really focus on their own pleasure.
Whoa. Even if it's like a subconscious kind of thought.
Yeah, it usually is.
Whoa. Yeah, because even like, I mean, anytime I've watched like normal straight porn, I'm like, this is like all right. It's almost like in porn when there's kind of like a plot or a buildup, it's more exciting than like the actual just action of it, because it's just kind of like meat.
Yeah.
And like, all right. You know what I'm saying? Does that make
Did
sense?
Did you just say meat?
The meat is out there.
Did that make sense?
You don't want to see your meat.
So, like, that's it. But I love that you brought this up, because people are stimulated by different kinds of visuals, right? Some people are like, give me the genitals. All I want to see is the genitals. And it does it for them.
Yeah.
Great. More power to you. Mm-hmm. And other people are like, that is so boring.
Yeah.
I need to see some context. I need to see some character around
I'm
the meat.
One of those people.
Yeah.
Like, I need like the plot, the love story.
Exactly.
I also thought it was maybe just looking at how to do it, you know? And like maybe like this position.
Like learning.
Yeah, exactly.
But even then, with what you just said, it's almost like it's a little unrealistic. Like, can you learn from porn?
You can't. I don't want to be black and white about this subject, right? Like, you absolutely can learn about different positions and you can learn different things to try. And
yeah,
like, what you don't learn is how to switch positions gracefully often, because the camera edits don't show people very frequently, like, being awkward as you dismount and remount and do all things. So I think there's a lot that is not depicted realistically, and you can learn some new ideas.
So for people who want to talk about these things with their partner, how would they kind of bring it up if it's kind of a taboo topic to talk about, or also they don't feel comfortable?
Well, probably not during sex, right? I would recommend that people talk about whatever they want to talk about at a time when they're both in a good headspace to, like, have a real conversation that can be vulnerable. So not a great conversation to start when you're rushing to work, not a great conversation to have over text, not a great conversation to have while you're in the middle of having sex, because you're vulnerable, right? And you want to create a context where there's space for vulnerability to really be attuned to and cared for. And I like to recommend that people lead with vulnerability, right? Show your partner that you're taking a risk too, and you're here for it together, right? So that could sound like, hey, I would love to spend some time talking about sex. How do you feel about that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, is now a good time? Do you have the bandwidth for that?
Whoa, okay.
Right? Yeah. And really, like, setting yourselves up for success in that space. And then really kind of be clear. Do you want to talk about fantasies? Do you want to talk about protection? Do you want to talk about something that was really awesome the last time you were sexual, or something that maybe didn't do it for you? But if you get in a practice of regularly talking about sex, especially debriefing after you've had sex, give each other feedback constructively and with care, right? Then you get in the practice of being able to normalize this. And then if there is something that's really big, you already have some safety built with each other where maybe it doesn't feel so out of left field.
Like, hey, you went too deep. Don't do that. Don't do that.
I didn't like that.
Actually, my clitoris is over here.
Yes, that part.
A for effort. And
A for effort. It's actually up here.
But, like, really, like, sandwich your constructive feedback with something that is complimentary. Like, I really love the way you're doing that thing with your tongue. Let's move it just a little bit over in this direction. Oh my God, yes, you're on point.
Yeah.
Like, really be okay about giving that feedback.
You said
no. Well, no, I think in the moment, if you've got some feedback where you're like, hey, love what you're doing, let's move it in this direction, that can be really useful, but, like, maybe not bringing up new fantasies in the moment.
So before we move on to our next segment, I think to wrap this all up, what are ways to naturally overcome, like, as a society and speaking with your friends and your family about sex, what's a way to overcome the shame and the uncomfortability of talking about sex?
Good question. I would say you can be the person who starts the conversations and really hold space for other people to talk about it. Now, if you are in a community where talking about sex has been pretty taboo, that can come with some risks for you too. So maybe you find other like-minded friends or folks that you feel comfortable with and do a book club. You know, read a book that talks about sex, talk about it, get the practice together of, like, really bringing these conversations into your everyday life, and it gets way easier, right?
Yeah.
I talk about sex all day, every day with my clients, with my team. Mm-hmm. So in my friend groups, I'm often the person who's like, oh yeah, let's talk about that. Let's bring it out. You've got that going on. I've got time and space for that. Let's hear it. Right. And if you,
I love that.
Yeah, like, if you lead the way and you make it okay, other people usually are pretty grateful for that space, because most folks have questions and most folks feel really uncomfortable.
It's true. You're right. It's almost like, I don't know if you've seen Sex in the City. It's like the Samantha of the friend group. You always feel
so
safe
open
with having a friend who's open about talking about sex. You know, you can come to them.
We all need each other, right? Like, every friend in the friend group has something that they bring that's uniquely theirs, and that's valuable.
Okay, so Dr. Kate, we have a segment on our show where we like to open up the room, the table, to our audience. We encourage them to send us personal stories, questions that maybe they were too uncomfortable to ask their doctors or their family friends. So can we get a voice note, please?
Hey, Nye.
Hey.
I hope you're well. So sorry about calling earlier, but I do have a question. So if you do anal a lot, does that mean... Okay, I've always wanted to ask my doctor this, but I've been too shy. But if you do anal a lot, will your butthole stretch like to the point where like it can't close up anymore? Because I heard of like old people like pooping their pants because their booty holes can't close anymore. So I just want to know if that's true. And if so, is anal sex even safe? Thank you so much. And I hope you have an answer to my question.
Aww, love you so much. Yeah. Thank you for the question. That's actually so, a great question and a great starter. Yeah. That's a great starter. Yeah. Also hilarious the way she said that. So funny.
It is a vulnerable question for some people. So
yeah, no, I really appreciate that brave of you too.
That was awesome.
To leave that voicemail. Yeah. So our bodies are super resilient. And if we are taking care to engage in anal sex in a way that is gradual and can allow for elasticity to happen, usually there is very minimal risk of having a long-term injury or side effect. Sometimes if you go too fast, too big, and don't kind of give your body time to warm up and then you can run the risk of having an injury, at which point you would want to go see a doctor. And sometimes there are things they can do to kind of bring your body back to its typical baseline, you know.
To the girls and the gays, go really slow.
Well, and to the straight men who are doing it.
And the straight men that are doing it as well.
Like, go slow. Use fingers first, right? Ease your body into the experience of something being where you wouldn't normally put it. Use a small butt plug. Use lots and lots of lubricant. You know, lube, you cannot have too much lube, in my opinion. So just go slow, right? And breathe and let your body adapt to what's happening. And then if you feel like you want to take it to the next level, go for it. And if you don't, right? But like, really listen to your body and listen to what feels pleasurable. Because our anuses have a ton of nerve endings. And a lot of people really love that kind of stimulation. So,
I love your professionalism, Dr. Kate. You're amazing. You're incredible. Me giggling like a little girl over here.
Me breaking character.
Dr. Kate. I do think it's interesting that you mentioned lube, because I feel like that is something that like should be mentioned more. Like, people should include it in their sexual practices more often. I kind of feel like women don't. And it also feels like a little nerdy, I think. If I'm like, can we like bring out lube?
I'm going to tell you a secret. I don't really do Christmas presents, but when I do, I often will put lube in stockings.
Whoa.
Because I think we cannot have enough lube. And lube is one of those things that people are like, do I need this? Should I buy this? What brand do I buy? What do I do? And I just think it's the best stocking stuffer ever.
I love that.
Yeah.
I'm going to give my friends lube.
Giving my parents lube.
Yes, true. Okay, should we get another question?
Hey. So I have a couple of questions. The first one is, I just don't understand how lesbians have sex, and that's really difficult because I have a crush on a girl in my class and I want to have sex with her, but like, I've had sex with a man and it's, you know, like the penis is in there and it's like, okay, this is nice. But then I just feel like it's lacking with a girl, because like, you can like eat her pussy and you can like finger her, you can like do that to each other, but it's just not fun without a dick, you know?
Well, I don't think that's necessarily true.
I don't think it's necessarily true either. But I love her raw frustration.
True. Like, thank you for your question.
Yeah, let's honor that, because I think she really homes in on a point that is super misunderstood in our world. And again, if we had better sex education that talked about pleasure, we would have answers to these things earlier in life. But here's the thing. A lot of folks define sex as penis penetration into vagina or into an anus, right? And that's a really narrow and limited view of sex that really reinforces a patriarchal idea of heteronormative sex. True. So when we talk about sex for people who don't have penises, it's really important to think more expansively about pleasure, right? We have these whole beautiful bodies.
Yeah.
All these bodies with all of this landscape for touching and for sensory stimulation. So definitely there's some people who really love to be penetrated. And if there's no penis in sight or you're not interested in a penis, you can definitely use a strap-on. You can use dildos. You can use vibrators. You can engage in all kinds of digital, so finger stimulation. Some people even like fisting. Again, do it safely, gradually. But think about like how much more pleasure you might be able to access if you broaden your definition of what sex includes.
Wow. You are so intelligent, Dr. Kate. That's incredible. You're so right. And also, I mean, I've heard from so many girlfriends that like them with a female partner, they enjoy it 20 times more. It's more fun. It's more communicative. It could be more gentle. It could be fun and spunky as well. You can get creative. 'Cause you're right. There's not just like this, like, this is how you're supposed to do it.
Totally. So I really appreciate her question. And I hear this a lot from women who are bi-curious or who are looking to explore what it means to be sexual with women. And I think it really results from living in a culture that is so phallic focused. And most of us had a lot of messaging around what's called comphet, right? So compulsory heterosexuality, where we do focus a lot of attention on P to V penetration as the definition of sex. And listen, I'm not knocking any P to V. That can be awesome. And there's so much more going on. And when we take away P to V penetration as the focus, we do get more curious and more creative with how pleasure is experienced and facilitated. So I would say, you know, open your mind, kind of give yourself lots of possibilities and see where it takes you.
See where it takes you. Have fun. We have one more question.
Hi, Nai.
Hey.
So, I guess I know the answer to this question, but I think it's just a good conversation to have. What do you do when you queef? Like when you're having a with a guy
and you just, do?
You know, let it rip. What do you do? Like, I had an experience where I would, like, we were having sex, obviously I queefed, and I look at him, and he's trying so hard not to laugh, and I'm like, I'm so sorry, I literally apologize, and he goes, it's natural, it's fine. Like, oh, how do we avoid that at all costs? Like, oh, it's literally the worst. I hate it.
Like, I've been there.
I'm in the world. Like, ugh, if it's avoidable, like if I could avoid it, please. How?
Sex is nothing if it doesn't involve sounds and smells and all kinds. Like, sex is messy.
It's true.
Right? Like, whatever. If you queef, if you do, like, I'm of the school of thought that who cares? It's just part of the messiness and the humanity of sex. So let your queef fly.
We listen and we don't judge.
We listen and we don't judge.
Literally, we listen
to the queef that wants to be heard. We don't judge.
We queefed it out.
Well, wow, what a great way to wrap up this segment. Our final question, Dr. Kate, to wrap it all up. So we like to tie this last question back to ease. How can education on sex give us a sense of ease?
Oh, well, the more you know, right? Mm-hmm. When we have knowledge, we feel a lot less nervous. We have more to equip us with what to do, what we want to do. We have more options to choose from. So the more we know about sex, the more we can engage in exploration and choice activation. And like, let's think about the conversation we had here today, even just about queefing. Mm-hmm. Like having just a little bit more knowledge about how it's totally normal and it happens and it isn't a big deal. Hopefully that gives one person listening at least some ease the next time they're having sex, so that, yeah, if their body makes a goofy sound, like whatever, just roll with it.
Yeah.
I don't have to be bothered by this.
Yeah.
And that peace of mind is huge, because if you get in your head and you're obsessing about, oh my gosh, my body just did this thing, and now, you're leaving your body, mm-hmm. and departing your body during pleasure is a way to really limit the kind of pleasure that you're going to have. Mm-hmm. So it really helps us have a more integrated, confident way of being.
Yeah, because it's like, it's a part of us.
It's a part of us. Yeah, pleasure is a human right. It's a human experience. So...
wow.
Well, it was such a pleasure having you here. We're so glad that we got a chance to even talk to you and get your insight on everything. If you guys want to check out Dr. Kate's book and her podcast, we'll link it below. We'll see you next time.
Yeah, it was such an honor to have you on. Thank you for having this conversation with us.
Yeah, thank you both. These questions were amazing.
Thank you. Thank you. Make sure to check out Dr. Kate on all of her socials. We will have everything linked below. Yeah, that was it. We'll see you in the next one. Thank you. One round of applause for Dr. Kate, please, everybody.
Yes.
Thank you, Dr. Kate. We love you so much. Thank you.